You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Now, I figured there'd be quite a few here in that R, which is fantastic. I imagine you're all feeling a little bit like little Davids about to tackle the big Goliath oil companies. Well, you've got the right person to train you in this particular skill. Tessa Khan is an environmental lawyer and a campaigner. And when it comes to tackling big oil, she's got the T-shirt, she's got the scars, she's got the bruises. And the thing with Tessa is, she wins. She has so far stopped two oil fields from happening. And well done, yeah. And with your help, with you as foot soldiers, she'll be hopefully stopping a lot more. So if I was big oil right now, I would be afraid. Very afraid. Tessa, here are your foot soldiers. Come and instruct us. Tessa Khan, everybody.
Thanks so much, Michael. And thanks again to the whole crew behind the Pickwell Foundation as well. You guys are amazing and so grateful for the opportunity to speak with you all. I don't know about foot soldiers. It's maybe a little hierarchical for my liking. But I do believe that we can win, and I'm going to spend a bit of time today talking you through a few things. The first is why big oil is bad. That's probably the least controversial part. The second is what the oil and gas industry is up to here in the UK. And then finally, how we, as in all of us, have the power to stop the oil and gas industry. And by stopping them, and this is really why I wake up every day and am excited to do this work, but I believe that if we manage to do this here, it's not just going to have the impact of keeping a few billion barrels of oil in the ground, as massive a deal as that would be, but I think that if we can do it here, then we will set a precedent, a benchmark that will have global ripple effects. And I'm optimistic that we can win, that we can have that huge impact. And I know that right now, a lot of you will probably feel like we're on the back foot. And I think that that's because the oil and gas industry has seen the writing on the wall. It is out to make as much money as it can, to do as much damage as it can. But that if we redouble, quadruple, 5x, 10x our collective efforts, then we can beat them once and for all. So I want to start just by saying a few words about why big oil is a problem. And really there are three, I think, pretty compelling factors behind that. The first is one that you all already know about, which is the role that the oil and gas industry has played in driving the climate crisis. So we know, for example, beyond doubt, that it's the burning of fossil fuels, the burning of oil, gas and coal that are responsible for the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. We also know, thanks to extremely rigorous, credible work by organisations like the UN's Environment Programme, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and lots of peer-reviewed published research, that if we burn the oil and gas that is in fields that have already been approved, we are going to shoot straight past what has been internationally agreed to be a safe climate limit, which is the 1.5 degree threshold that governments around the world agreed to in the Paris Agreement. I'm sure many of you can probably infer from the damage that we're already seeing at roughly 1.2 to 1.3 degrees of warming that we are already past safe climate limits. But burning the oil and gas, as I said, in reserves that already exist will take us well past 1.5 and pushing right up to the 2 degree target that is an absolute ceiling that governments have agreed to. And in fact, we've heard that if governments were to produce all of the oil and gas that they are already planning to up until 2030, we would have exceeded by 100%, so double the amount of fossil fuels that we can burn if we're going to stay within that 1.5 degree limit. I think the other equally important influence that the oil and gas industry has on the climate, though, which is the one that's maybe less talked about, is the sheer amount of power, resource and effort that they have put into slowing down action on climate change more broadly. So we know that the oil and gas industry, companies like Exxon and Shell, some of the most well-known household names. They had scientists with their own companies who, in as early as the 1970s, knew that by burning oil and gas, they were going to contribute to climate change. And in fact, their projections are staggeringly accurate in terms of forecasting what that would do to the atmosphere and the implications that would flow from that. They then spent a ton of money, and in fact, they've spent tens of millions of dollars just since the Paris Agreement was signed, lobbying against action on climate change. They have deliberately misled the public, ploughed money into institutions that have obfuscated, that have actively deceived us, policymakers. They've done a huge amount of damage to our ability to take this agenda forward. And fundamentally, they are a block in a country like the UK, not just to policy on oil and gas, but to policy to progress action on climate change more generally. The second reason that the oil and gas industry is not good for us is because of the economic impact that the industry has. And again, that plays out in a couple of different ways. The first is our dependency on fossil fuels and on oil in particular has caused huge economic shocks tied to the oil price spiking at different points over the last few decades. So the Climate Change Committee last year, for example, said that since the 1970s, fossil fuel price shocks have been responsible for about half of all of the recessions that the UK has experienced. We know, for example, that the horrendous cost of living crisis that was precipitated in part by Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022 caused the gas price to increase, the wholesale gas price to increase by about fivefold. That has had all sorts of systemic implications for our economy. But I would say just as importantly, it has had an absolutely devastating effect on ordinary families, on households across the country who cannot afford to pay their household energy bills. And in the winter of 2022, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the increase in the gas price, millions of people were pushed into fuel poverty, were unable to heat their homes in the winter, were unable to turn their lights on so that their kids could study for school. And all of that is thanks to the extent to which we are dependent on these commodities. And the UK is actually more exposed than any other European country in terms of the gas price, because we are so dependent on gas to heat our homes. About 80% of people have a gas boiler in their houses, and because gas sets the price of the electricity that we use. It's used to generate roughly 40% of the electricity that we use across the country as well. So those are the economic implications. And then finally, and I think this is one that you're all familiar with as well, there have been absolutely catastrophic geopolitical and humanitarian consequences as a result of our dependency on oil and gas. We know that oil drives conflict. We know that countries have gone to war to secure oil and gas supplies. It played no small part in the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And we know that currently Russia's ability to export its oil and gas and find buyers around the world for that is what's meant that it's been able to maintain its coffers to prosecute its war in Ukraine. So these are all some pretty good reasons, I'm sure you'll agree, for us to get off fossil fuels and oil and gas as quickly as possible. So that's the, I would say, global picture. And I want to say a few words about the way that the oil and gas industry currently operates in the UK. So not many people realise this because all of this extraction, or the vast majority, more than 95% of this extraction, happens in the North Sea and North Atlantic. So it's kind of, especially for folks around here, out of sight and out of mind. But the UK is the second largest oil and gas producer in Europe. Even though the North Sea is a mature, declining basin, we are still extracting roughly 1 million barrels of oil and gas equivalent a day from the North Sea. We also have an oil and gas regulator that has a legal duty. Its principal legal objective is to maximise economic recovery of offshore oil and gas. We can query how it is that you reconcile that with all of the climate change targets that are also statutory in the UK, but at the moment, that is what the oil and gas regulator's principal job is, and that is written into law. The other really astonishing thing that I learned when I first started working on this issue a few years ago is that until the windfall tax on the oil and gas sector was introduced in 2022, and I'm going to say a few more words about the windfall tax in a moment, but before that, the UK basically offered the most generous tax rates to oil and gas companies of any oil and gas producing country in the world. So despite being, you know, a 50-year-old basin that's really on very expensive to extract from, all the easy stuff to find has already been drilled, it was the most profitable place for offshore oil and gas operators to operate in 2018. And the tax regime that the oil and gas industry has lobbied for and secured is so generous that in the last 10 years, there have been 2 years where we, the UK taxpayer, paid out more in tax rebates to the oil and gas sector than they paid into the UK Treasury. So that is an astonishing set of facts, I think, especially when we take into account just how profitable that industry has been. So the final thing that I want to say about the way that the industry operates here is the extraordinary amount of political influence, access, and power that this industry has. And that, I think, really works in three different ways. The first is, well, we know that the British state has always been very close to the oil and gas industry. It was, back in the day, a majority shareholder in British Petroleum, BP. But what we now see is the industry operating to influence our politics, and I would say to capture our politics in a few distinct ways. The first is straight-up lobbying. So the oil and gas industry lobby, which is called Offshore Energies UK, recently rebranded from being Oil and Gas UK. So OE UK's headquarters are a short stroll from Downing Street and the Houses of Parliament. We know that they have meetings all the time with ministers, with civil servants, with MPs, with MSPs, so members of the Scottish Parliament, who are an incredibly important constituency in all of this, given Scotland is where the extraction and most of the jobs in the industry are located. There is also what's called a revolving door between the oil and gas industry and our government. So that is to say that people come into government from the industry, they leave government, go into the industry, and that way we can ensure, the industry can ensure that its interests are always being served, that its agenda is at being heard. And I can give you one example of that, which is that Equinor, which is one of the largest oil companies operating in the UK, and the company that is trying to currently develop the UK's largest undeveloped oil field, the Rosebank oil field. So the UK's former ambassador to Sweden about 7 or 8 years ago was brought into Equinor to be its head of external affairs, i.e. its chief lobbyist. So you can imagine the list of contacts that he brought with him. And he recently, in the last few months, has left Equinor to become the UK's ambassador to Argentina. So it continues, the revolving door continues to turn. We also know that there is a straight-up financial interest that many of our MPs, not many, dozens, I would say, dozens of MPs and members of the House of Lords, we know, have shares in the oil and gas industry. We know that the oil and gas regulator is staffed by people who have significant financial interests still in the industry, who came from the industry, and who I think we have a right to deserve a more independent, a more autonomous, and a more transparent approach to policymaking in this country. So I really I appreciate how overwhelming all of that can sound. It can sound insurmountable. And as Michael said, you know, it can really, I think, make the industry out to be a Goliath. But aside from the fact that I think we've got thousands of Davids on our side, I also know for a fact that the industry is beatable. And I can point to, I think, a few things that have happened just in the last 5 years that show that the oil and gas industry's power in the UK is diminishing, that its grip on our politics is weakening, and that we are around the corner, I think, from really winning big on this agenda. So, starting in 2021, you may have heard or remember that there was a very controversial oil field that Shell was trying to develop called Cambo. Cambo is the second largest undeveloped oil field in the UK. It's got about 200 million barrels of oil to be extracted. And up until Cambo basically attracted the public spotlight, thanks to so many of you and the work that you've all done to draw attention to it, the oil and gas industry has rarely had any scrutiny applied to its applications to develop oil fields. It puts its applications forward, the oil and gas regulator takes a look, the minister in charge takes a look, and it gets waved through with very little public scrutiny. But Cambo was brought forward in the same year that the UK was hosting the UN climate talks. And that, we thought, was a bit of a problem for the UK to be presiding over a conference that was supposed to increase our ambition globally to address climate change while also considering approving a massive new oil field. And so together with hundreds of organisations, thousands of activists across the country, we started a campaign called Stop Cambo, and we stopped Cambo. We ended up with Shell withdrew from the field as an investor in December 2021. The field has gone nowhere. Boris Johnson refused to take interviews in the lead up to COP out of fear that he would be asked about Cambo. And that is the kind of power I think that we can bring to bear when we work together. But that was, I think, the first moment that we started to show that there are cracks in the power that the industry has. In 2022, thanks to, as I described earlier, the outrageous profiteering of the oil and gas industry off the back of Russia's invasion in Ukraine, the huge financial distress that people found themselves in because of their household energy bills, and the incredibly lopsided tax regime we have for the oil and gas industry, people started to call for a windfall tax on an industry that was making literally unprecedented profits, profits that they hadn't experienced in the 100 years since they had been founded. And that led, under a conservative government that has, let's say, been a friend to the oil and gas industry and that doesn't really take lightly to imposing taxes on corporate sectors, the Conservative government in November 2022 introduced a 25% windfall tax on the industry that has led to tens of billions of pounds of value being taken off that industry. We know that it's deterred investment in the North Sea. The oil and gas industry is suddenly very unsure about whether or not it's got the friends in government that it used to have and whether or not it can get away with extraction at the level of profitability that it's been used to without any public scrutiny. So that was another huge win. In 2024, the UK Supreme Court, thanks to the incredibly tenacious and persistent efforts of a campaigner called Sarah Finch, who has been campaigning for years against onshore oil drilling in Surrey, she basically challenged the consent to drill for oil at a development called Horse Hill. She lost her initial challenge. She lost again in the Court of Appeal. She took her appeal to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court agreed with Sarah that it makes absolutely no sense that at the moment in the UK, or rather in 2024 in the UK, and for as long as we've been extracting oil and gas in this country, when the government does an environmental assessment for a new oil and gas field, which it has to do, as it does with most new infrastructure projects, it doesn't have to take into account the single biggest environmental impact of those fields, which is burning the oil and gas that's within them. And so the Supreme Court, unsurprisingly, agreed that that was an absurd state of affairs that made absolutely no sense on the face of it or on the face of the law. And so thanks to Sarah's efforts, she has ensured, and the UK government has now written this into the regulations, but when we approve new oil and gas fields in this country, oil and gas companies have to come clean about the full climate impact of their fields. That means genuinely being transparent and honest about what the climate implications are, for example, of burning the roughly 500 million barrels of oil in the Rosebank oil field, which would create the same amount of climate pollution as running 56 coal-fired power plants for a year, or the same amount of pollution as the 28 lowest income countries in the world do annually. So that is a game changer, and I think once again is something that is putting the oil and gas industry in this country on the back foot. Also, and just honestly, a massive, massive shout out to Sarah for, I think, in the face of years of unhelpful legal precedents and scepticism, managing that win. So I think that's inspiration for all of us. The other very significant thing that happened in 2024, as I'm sure you all know, is that we elected a Labor government. I'm sure you all have your disagreements with some of what this government has done. But when it was elected again thanks to the significant amount of scrutiny on whether or not the oil and gas industry in the UK is really working to benefit the British public. The Labor Party was elected on a manifesto in which it committed to ending new licensing for exploring for oil and gas in the North Sea. That is a huge deal insofar as it's the first G7 country in the world to make a commitment of that nature. It is the largest oil and gas producing country in the world to have made a commitment to end new oil and gas exploration. Is it enough? No. But does it send a very clear signal to the oil and gas industry that its days of drilling with no checks on that, with no scrutiny of whether or not it's in the public interest, are over? Yes. And so I think there is no room for us to be complacent about the implementation of that commitment. And I'm going to talk more about how we make sure that they come good on that. But that is also a massive testament to the power of campaigning and the power of lobbying that so many of you have been involved in. So that was 2024. 2025, earlier this year, we stopped Rosebank. So that was also great news. We didn't do it on our own. The Rosebank oil field was approved by the Conservative government in 2023. There was a massive campaign that I am going to say more about in a moment to demonstrate how outraged the public was about that decision. It culminated in, among other things, Uplift, my organisation, and Greenpeace UK filing a legal challenge against the government's decision to approve Rosebank. And in January this year, the Scottish Court of Session agreed with us, again, thanks to the precedent that Sarah Finch had set, that it was unlawful for the UK government to have approved the Rosebank oil field without taking into account what happens to the environment when you burn 500 million barrels of oil. So that's very good news as well. All of that is to say that, you know, as I've been saying, and I know it's hard to believe, but we are in a moment that really matters. There are a few things that the government is basically poised to make a decision on that could be transformative for the future of the oil and gas industry and for the climate agenda in this country. The first is the government is about to announce what its final position is on new exploration licences for oil and gas in the North Sea. As I said, it was a manifesto commitment not to issue any more. Things have changed since July 2024. The Labor Party's changed, the world has changed, the oil and gas industry, as I said, has spied an opportunity among other countries rolling back on climate. And so we can't take for granted that that commitment will survive. But it is one that the government is due to make an announcement about in November this year. The second thing is that the government is due to make a fresh decision about the Rosebank oil field. So we did stop the previous decision from being considered to be legally valid. But of course, that doesn't stop the developers, Equinor and another oil company, Ithaca Energy, from resubmitting its application, this time disclosing the full environmental impact and asking the government to approve it. So they haven't yet submitted their applications, but we suspect that the UK government will make a decision on whether or not Rosebank goes ahead for a second time early next year, if not later this year. And Cambo is potentially back as well. Under this new regime, with a new owner, in fact, the same owner that is a co-owner in Rosebank, Ithaca Energy, they are quite keen to take advantage of higher oil prices and what they consider to be a more conducive international environment to reapply. So those are two very big decisions that we need to keep an eye on. Third, the government is also going to be making an announcement later this year about what the future of the tax regime is for the oil and gas industry. And I really don't want to be the person up here talking about tax at 1 p.m. On a Sunday afternoon. But as I said, this stuff really matters. It determines whether or not it is a profitable venture for the oil and gas industry. It determines how competitive really the UK is globally in attracting investment in more oil and gas. And so we need to make sure that the UK government understands that we need a tax system that operates in our interests and not in the interests of a handful of incredibly profitable oil and gas companies. Finally, the UK government is also turning its mind to a really crucial part of this whole picture that I haven't spoken about yet, but which matters to us as much as keeping oil and gas in the ground, and that is what the future is for the workers and the communities that have historically had ties to the oil and gas industry. You know, the UK has benefited massively from North Sea oil and gas in the last few decades. It's heated our homes. It has created employment for hundreds of thousands of people across the country. But now, as I said, it's an industry that simply cannot have a future if we are going to stay within a safe climate. It's also an industry for whom the writing is on the wall, given the declining nature of the North Sea Basin anyway. So we now need to make sure that the people, the tens of thousands of people who are oil and gas workers in the UK, primarily in Scotland, the tens of thousands of people more who are indirectly employed by that industry, that they are not left on the scrap heap when the government does the right thing by phasing out oil and gas. And basically what we cannot have is a repeat of what happened with coal mining in this country, with community level scarring that lasts for generations, that makes industrial transition absolutely toxic for years to come. If we don't get this transition right, I can tell you right now, it's going to be incredibly difficult to transition all of the other high carbon industries that this country will need to in the years to come. And so we've got to make sure that the oil and gas workforce, 90% of whom, by the way, have skills that could be deployed in offshore renewables, and we're incredibly lucky in this country to have an alternative industry right there in the North Sea, the fifth largest offshore wind industry in the world, that could really be the principal employer for so many of the people, for the supply chains that are currently involved in oil and gas. We've got to make sure that we do the right thing there. So that is what's at stake. And so the question now is, what do we need to do to win? And I think it really comes down to three things. The first thing is we need to tell a better story than the oil and gas industry is telling. And they have had a lock on the media in this country. They are incredibly savvy in their press releases, in their social media influence. You know, it's a powerful media machine. But we can tell a story, I think, that really takes apart what they say about the benefit that oil and gas brings to the UK. And I think there are a few things that we really need to hammer in all of the conversations we have, in all of the ways that we talk about oil and gas. The first is we need to keep hammering again and again the climate argument. I know that that's not going to be hard for all of you, but we need to, as much as possible, connect that climate argument to the fact that people across this country are experiencing those harms right now. Scotland has experienced its largest wildfires in the last month. British farmers have had some of the worst harvests in the last 2 years, whether that's the drought that's been declared in multiple parts of the UK in the last couple of months, or the incredibly wet winter that we had 2 years ago. It's having tangible, commercial, real effects on communities all over this country, and that's what we need to talk about. We also need to call the industry out on all of its BS talking points about energy security, about affordable energy, about the fact that the oil and gas industry can be trusted to drive this transition towards renewable energy. So I think we need to just get a few things straight. On energy security, and that is, I think, one of the biggest challenges that we have at a moment when governments are nervous, there is war in Europe, you know, Russia's oil and gas supplies are being diverted away from a lot of countries that have previously been dependent on it. In general, things are feeling pretty fragile and people are worried about the cost of living. We need to be absolutely clear that North Sea oil and gas does materially nothing for our domestic energy security, and that's because we export more than 80% of the oil that is produced in the North Sea. It belongs to private companies. It doesn't belong to us. And it will be sold to whoever they can find that will pay the highest price for it on international markets. Most of what's now left in the North Sea is oil. It goes straight onto an oil tanker and it then heads to Europe or to wherever in the world they will get the best price for it. It's not going into British cars. It's not powering British industry. It's not making us more energy secure. Even a large chunk of our gas, and we have very little gas left. So gas is what you will often hear about, because gas prices are what we've really been struggling with recently. There is so little gas left in the North Sea that in the last 10 years, we've handed out hundreds of oil and gas licences, and it has produced a grand total of 16 days worth of gas in the last decade. So the next time somebody tells you that we need North Sea oil and gas to meet our domestic gas demand, you can quote that statistic or any of the other ones that you will find on the Uplift website. But that's in addition, as I said, to gas producers also being free, as they do for about 40% of the gas that's produced, to export that to Europe as well. The other thing that is a favourite narrative of the oil and gas industry is the idea that they can be trusted to become the big renewable energy producers of the future. Happily, I actually think it's quite helpful that they are not even pretending anymore, I would say, in the last year, that that's the case. So companies like Shell and BP, who have made a huge song and dance and I think have actually spent more on their advertising budgets, advertising their renewable energy investments, than they've actually invested in renewable energy portfolios. They've dropped their renewable energy targets. They have come clean about the fact that oil and gas is what keeps their investors and their shareholders happy. It's what they do best, and that's what they are committed to doing for the foreseeable future. BP's dropped its renewable production target. Shell's done the same. This is not an industry that is going to be the one that drives us towards a clean energy future. And in the UK, fewer than 10% of the oil and gas companies operating in the North Sea invest a penny in renewable energy production. And a handful of those are developing renewable energy to power their offshore oil and gas platforms. So it's not renewable energy that's going into the grid. It's renewable energy that's being used to drill for more oil and gas. So let's put that argument to bed. The other thing I want to say is that on jobs, and this will bring me to my second point, you know, it's, I think, as I said, a legitimate question as to what happens to the tens of thousands of people who work in the oil and gas sector. And the oil and gas industry will insist that unless we develop new fields, unless the government issues new oil and gas licenses, then thousands of people more will lose their jobs. But the reality is that because of the declining nature of the North Sea Basin, despite having an unbelievably pro-oil and gas government for the last 10 years in this country that issued hundreds of new oil and gas licences, the workforce supported by the North Sea industry halved in the last decade. And that's, as I said, the reality of a declining basin. Those are people who already need support. It does not make a difference to the long-term livelihoods of those communities to issue a few more new oil and gas licenses. What they need is a proper transition plan. And that's the third thing that I think we've really got to be very clear in calling for. We need a plan to make sure that those workers and communities are supported. As I said, we're in this amazing position, which is why I was so excited to set up Uplift, where we have a fifth of the world's global offshore capacity. We're planning to sixfold increase our offshore wind generation in the next few years to meet the government's clean energy targets. We could have a booming industry that creates tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of jobs. But what needs to change about the way that offshore wind is developed in the UK is we need more of the kit that is in the offshore wind farms to be made here, because manufacturing is what creates good long-term jobs. At the moment, the jobs are mostly in maintenance of offshore wind farms, but everything that we're buying, the majority of what's in a wind turbine, is being manufactured elsewhere. So we need the government to incentivize more domestic manufacturing. We need more fabrication plants built here. We need more factories here, and we need those to be unionised jobs that are good jobs that people can really depend on, because those are the jobs that they currently think they have in oil and gas. So that's what we've got to do. The question is how we do it. And it's not going to surprise you to hear, given the scale of the challenge that we have ahead of us, we're going to need everyone, and we're going to need pretty much every tactic in our toolbox. That's a mixed metaphor, every tool in our toolbox. We're going to basically, I think the number one job, if I'm completely honest, is we need to convince this government who does not believe that this is the case, we need to convince them that people care about climate change. At the moment, the UK government genuinely does not think that people are going to vote on the basis of what its climate policies are, that there are issues that are far more salient in the way that people think about what they want from their governments than their climate change policy. And even though we know the polling tells us time and time again, and this is part of what's so frustrating, but the UK is an outlier in all of the countries that I've worked in. There is no country where the public has as consistently supported action on climate change, regardless of where you live, regardless of who you vote for, regardless of how old you are. The level of support for climate action in this country is high and has stayed pretty stable over the last 10 years or so. But the challenge is that politicians aren't hearing about it on the doorstep. They're not hearing about it from their constituents. Number 10 doesn't think that people care about it, and that's what we have to change their mind about. So you know what that involves, because so many of you already do it so well, but it means you need to write to your MPs, you need to write to your local newspapers, you need to call into Talkback Radio or into your local radio programs. You need to talk about it on social media. You need to talk to your friends and your family. One of the biggest, actually, challenges that people have in talking about how much they care about climate change is a misconception that they're the only one that cares about climate change, when actually what we know is that everybody is worried, regardless of whether you're in the Red Wall or you're in this part of the country or you're in Aberdeen. People are really concerned and they can see the impacts of climate change already. The more we tell one another how we're feeling and the more we make it safe to make this an issue that we insist politicians care about, the more we'll build our power. I also think that it's really important that we all know that the more of us who are in this fight, the more likely we are going to win. And so if you can act in concert with more than one other person, then all the better. So there are a gazillion climate campaign groups that you can, I'm sure, join in your local area. We have actions as well, and I'm going to talk a bit more about the Stop Rosebank campaign and how you can get involved. But there are calls for people to show up on the streets, to demonstrate however you feel most comfortable demonstrating. We recently had an action by a group called the North Sea Knitters, who staged a knit-in in the offices of Equinor in Aberdeen, which was very effective. So if that's your vibe, then there is a group for you. But I can assure you that there are people like you who want to make their voices heard, and the more we can do that together, the more likely we are to win. So let's talk about how all of this applies in the context of a very imminent fight that we have on our hands, which is against the Rosebank oil field. And then I'm going to stop so we have some time for questions. I'm not sure how long I've been talking. Is that okay? Yeah, great. Okay. So let me just tell you a little bit about Rosebank and why, in my view, it is an encapsulation of everything that's wrong with energy policy in this country. So A, it is the largest undeveloped oil field in the UK at 500 million barrels. I've already told you what the climate implications of that are, running 56 coal-fired power plants for a year. It's really, really bad at a time when, as I said, the science is very clear that we cannot add new oil and gas fields to the existing pile of oil and gas fields that are already in reserve. The second thing about Equinor is that it's owned by two companies who are completely uninterested in what's good for me or you. So the first is Equinor, which is a Norwegian state-owned oil company. It's made a lot of money for Norwegian pensioners, and I can tell you that Norwegian pensioners are very excited about the prospect of the development of the Rosebank oil field. And one of the reasons for that is because of the ginormous tax breaks that Equinor and Ithaca will receive for developing that field. So WWF Norway did an assessment on the basis of basically the average oil price. If that oil price more or less holds for the next 30 years, which is the lifetime of the Rosebank oil field, the UK Exchequer stands to make an effective net loss of about £200 million on that field. So as much as you might hear Rachel Reeves or Keir Starmer talking about how we need new oil and gas fields for growth or for tax revenue, I can tell you right now that Rosebank is not going to bring us a positive amount of tax. It is, in fact, going to have a net negative effect on our tax balance in the UK. The next thing to say about Rosebank, which I've already said before, is that it's going to do very little for our energy security. It's oil for export. 90% of what's in Rosebank is oil. And if you look at the gas that's in that field, it will make about a 1% difference to the UK's overall dependency on gas imports, which is, in my view, not a price we should be prepared to pay for developing the biggest undeveloped field in 2025. Finally, and this is, I think, something that fewer people know about. So I said Equinor is one of the developers of the field. Ithaca Energy is the other developer. Ithaca Energy is an Israeli energy company owned by the parent company of which is Delek. So Delek is a Israeli energy company that has been specifically listed by the UN for its illegal activity in settlements in Palestine. It's been blacklisted for its potential human rights violations by the UN. And according to our calculations, the profits flowing from Rosebank to Delek would be in the region of hundreds of millions of pounds. We also know that Delek is a subsidiary of another group, of another company that is currently supplying fuel to the IDF, obviously at a time when the IDF is engaged in genocide. So I think there's another very significant moral challenge that is in addition to the climate challenge that we have, which is a very good reason to stop the Rosebank oil field. So that said, I think we are in a good place to make this happen. We've had an incredibly broad and diverse campaign with a huge range of tactics that, as I said, culminated in a legal challenge that overturned the initial development consent that was given to Rosebank in 2022. And we now have a campaign that has involved a petition of 1 million people being handed in to Number 10, saying that they oppose the development of the Rosebank oil field. There have been more than 100 musicians just in the last couple of weeks also sign a petition for Number 10, including Paloma Faith, Robert Smith from The Cure, Lola Young, Brian Eno, and a bunch of others have made it clear that they oppose Rosebank. We've had, in our estimation, about 50,000 media mentions of Rosebank in the last couple of years, including countless broadcast interviews, 400 faith leaders, 700 scientists, more than 80 public actions across the country against Rosebank, including choirs, knit-ins, public challenges to Norwegian royalty and Norway's ambassador to the UK, and multiple interventions at Equinor's AGMs. There have also been more than 70 mentions of Rosebank in both the UK and Scottish parliaments. So needless to say, there is some momentum to build on. We're in a good place, I think, to actually take this thing to its final conclusion and kill this oil field once and for all, but it is really going to require all of us. And the good news is that we actually have a National Day of Action against Rosebank planned for September the 6th. And I would really, really appreciate it if everyone got involved. Basically, we will have actions up and down the country, from city centres to seaside towns, marching, rallying, knitting. Knitting is a really consistent theme in Rosebank Action. I'm going to talk to my colleagues about that, but I'm all for it. Banner dropping, showing up basically however you feel most comfortable to let the people in power know that they cannot put the profits associated with this ridiculous oil field above our safety, our future, our children, and the planet. And I really think that it would be amazing if everyone could go to the Stop Rosebank website, sign up for the mailing list, and figure out what you can do for the National Day of Action. Thank you so much. Oh, can I just add that the amazing folks at Christian Climate Action have some Stop Rosebank flyers and a banner and, in general, some merch if people are interested.
Yeah, thank you. It was a really amazing speech. Is there anywhere, kind of resources-wise, you shared so many phenomenal stats and counter-arguments and counter-things. Is there a very accessible resource you could point us to where if you're in a discussion or debate or you know you're about to be, that you can kind of refresh your mind on some of those sort of things that you've shared really quickly and easy, almost like an FAQs type thing, so that then you can go in equipped with the facts, the figures, and all of that sort of thing?
Hi, thank you for all your work. You're an absolute champion. There have been a few publications in the past few years that have given me a lot of kind of hope that we've got more powerful tools in our toolbox, essentially, to fight big oil. And one of them was the ability of some researchers to use modelling tools to figure out exactly how much in terms of temperature rise, a company is responsible for, which before they said, oh, it's all so like everything's all floating around in the air. You can't really blame us because you can't pinpoint exactly how much we've contributed to that. But researchers have published a paper saying, actually, you can pinpoint you are responsible for this much and put it in a kind of this is how much you owe a community for the damages. In the context of some of the big legal challenges, like with the six young people from Portugal, and then I can't remember whether they were from Finland or Sweden, a group of women who did win a case. I think those two cases kind of learned from each other a bit. What's your perspective on the kind of climate lawsuit legal challenges? Do you feel like that's going to give a good push of momentum, or like what effect do you think that's going to have, especially with the advances of the modelling and the evidence that we can put forward?
Great. Yeah, sure. Great questions. Thank you so much. Resources and kind of FAQ documents. I would point you, if you're looking for the best kind of facts and talking points, on Rosebank, the Stop Rosebank website. But for the oil and gas sector more generally and energy security and that kind of thing, if you go to the Uplift website, we've got briefings there that should be helpful. So that's upliftuk.org. Thanks so much. And great question about whether or not, basically, as I understand it, you know, you're saying, are we in a position to sue individual oil and gas companies for the damage that they've done to the climate? The answer is yes, and it's already happening. So there is increasingly compelling and robust research that can basically, what's known as attribution research, so it can take a particular weather event, whether that's a hurricane or a storm, and then look at the implications that climate change has had on how probable that event is. So that plus the science that can tell you exactly how much greenhouse gas emission in volume Shell is responsible for compared to the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere now, you can basically draw a line between how responsible, proportionately speaking, Shell is for a particular event. And there was, in fact, a Peruvian farmer who recently sued Germany's big energy company, RWE, in a German court. So he lives in a village in the Andes and is at imminent risk of flooding because of melting glaciers in the Andes. And the argument that he made in court was that RWE should be responsible for paying the proportion of costs that he is going to be responsible for relocating his home in direct proportion to how much RWE has contributed to the current concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. What that actually amounted to was something like £15,000, you know, a nominal amount. But it did establish a very important principle of liability. The German court agreed that actually that is in principle possible. It disagreed on the facts with what was being argued, but it opened the door to, I think, a suite of litigation that we are about to see in which people will be taking oil and gas companies to court to hold them responsible in relation to damage that is being experienced now or that's being anticipated in the future. So, yeah, I would definitely say watch this space.
Hi, Tessa. Thanks. I'm Val from CCA. We're doing a vigil on Stop Rosebank at Scottish Parliament on Tuesday. What would you ask Scottish MSPs to do regarding Grangemouth in particular, where 400 workers lost their jobs, and there doesn't seem to have been any benefit to them at all. There's been no transition.
I live 100 metres away from the perimeter of England's second largest oil refinery on Merseyside, and because I'm on a parish council, I have an opportunity to attend a liaison meeting with the management of the refinery twice a year. I'd be very grateful for some tips about technical questions I can ask them, because I am not a technical person to hold them to account. And a subsidiary question is, because we are already in a power generation area and we've been designated a national infrastructure site on Merseyside, we're also getting HyNet, we're getting hydrogen fuel developments, we're getting solar farms. Personally, this probably affects a lot of other people here too, but solar farms don't seem to me to be a sustainable way of generating renewable fuel, because they take out so much land and because they are polluting in themselves. Have you got any views on that?
I do, yes. but I might start with Val's question. Thank you so much, Val. It's amazing what you're doing. I think, so as I said, Scotland is such an important part of this conversation for obvious reasons. But the challenge is that the Scottish Parliament doesn't itself have power over the future of oil and gas development in the UK. But the position that Scottish MSPs take on individual projects like Rosebank and on the future of oil and gas in general is incredibly persuasive for when the UK government and UK Labour, I would say in particular, thinks about what its policy should be. So it really matters. And I think the SNP-led government in Scotland has been dodging the question for a long time of what its view is, because under Nicola Sturgeon, it took quite a progressive stance when it came to oil and gas development. She introduced a presumption against, I mean, not good enough, certainly, but, you know, kind of moving in the right direction, a presumption against new licensing. The current iteration of the Scottish Government's leadership is very nervous about that and refuses to publish its much-awaited energy security and just transition plan, which we've been waiting for about 3 years now. So, A, it would be great if they published that and in it confirmed that they oppose new oil and gas development. But crucially, I think for people at Grangemouth, you know, this is another example of unbelievably predictable industrial transition happening when you have irresponsible owners of key bits of infrastructure, midstream oil and gas infrastructure like refineries, who don't get the profits they once did or now expect from those places, and then they decide overnight without consulting with workers or trade unions to close down. And that's why we really need forward planning from the Scottish Government and from the UK Government to ensure that unions are at the table, workers are at the table, the industry is kept to the sidelines, and that these transitions happen in the public interest. So that's what I would really emphasise. On the more technical oil refinery point, perhaps we can have a chat afterwards so I don't bore people with oil refinery chat too much. But on solar, I mean, I have to say, you know, the amazing thing about being alive in 2025 is there is literally no cheaper way to generate electricity than pointing a sheet of glass at the sun. Like, that is a miracle, and in my view, something we are unbelievably lucky to be able to say. The cost of solar power generation has decreased by about 90% in the last decade, and that is an extraordinary development in our energy system that, you know, is going to unlock in most parts of the world clean energy and a transition away from fossil fuels. Now, if we build solar farms to deliver the UK's current solar power targets, that would still take up less land than we use to play golf in this country. So I think let's do it. I also think, I mean, that said, I also think, you know, we should be building, and I'm delighted that the UK government's agreed to do this, but, you know, new schools will have solar on the roof. I think there are probably people, there are definitely people here who know more about the details of that policy than I do, but we should be putting putting solar panels on every parking lot, on every school, on every hospital. It's already bringing down the price of energy for schools and hospitals across this country. So, I mean, you know, unfortunately, we've left this transition too late. That's the reality. You know, we are going to have to make some trade-offs and some compromises if we are going to have a habitable planet. And that is going to require some of us to be inconvenienced in some way. It's going to require us to have infrastructure in our communities that we're not happy with. But the trade-off is too enormous. The stakes are too high, I think, for us to put our short-term individual interest over the collective interest and habitability of our planet, I think.
Oh, hang on. Hi there. I've heard people from the fossil fuels industry and indeed the mining industry say things like, oh, well, you're going to have to take it out of the ground because you can't make solar panels or wind turbines without those products from those industries. I don't know what you think about that. I'd be interested to know. But secondly, would it be possible to license oil fields or whatever to only be used for extraction for industry or for manufacturing and not be used for burning and to put again to the sky?
My question is about new fields versus incremental, like brownfield development of existingly consented fields. I understand why Uplift focus on brand new fields that have never been in development, because it's kind of easier for the public to wrap their heads around. But the reality is that most of the production in the next 20 years is coming from additional wells in already consented fields. And the reality is, and I've got a bit of a regulatory background, once you've got the initial field development consent, it's really easy to like massively extend it, and there's a lack of regulatory oversight and kind of public scrutiny of those additional wells. So I guess the question is there space in the conversation to talk about redevelopments of old fields or extensions to those in production? Thank you.
Yeah, great questions. So, yes, I've heard this from the oil and gas industry as well, like the idea that actually, you know, you need oil and gas for petrochemicals, for manufacturing, for things that we all actually need and don't currently have substitutes for. At least 85% of oil and gas that is produced ends up being burnt for fuel. Like, that is the primary purpose of oil and gas. And that's why the Supreme Court in this country said that that is the principal environmental account that needs to be, principal environmental impact that needs to be accounted for when you're extracting oil and gas. So that is a marginal use that we are currently putting oil towards. And it's also true that at the moment it is impossible to imagine a regulatory regime in which companies agree and also have control over the end use of their product, such that the companies that are extracting it can then control what it's ultimately used for. So it's possibly an idea that has merit in theory. I really struggle to see how it would work in practice. And then the other thing that I would say, which, you know, I often do say, is that if we were going to just shrink down the amount of production that we have to those few uses that aren't just burning it, you definitely wouldn't be extracting the stuff that we have in the UK. And that is because the UK is one of the most expensive places in the world to currently drill for oil and gas from, because of, you know, as I said, the nature of the basin, how old it is. And that's why we need these insane tax breaks to make it profitable. If we were just going to limit production for those few uses, you would definitely be looking to places like Nigeria or elsewhere for that production to happen. Your point on extensions to existing fields being a real threat, I think, is a really important one. So we are campaigning against, you know, by we I mean the Stop Rosebank Coalition, Uplift and its many partners, are campaigning against new licences to explore for stuff that hasn't already been found. So that's the manifesto commitment that we need to hold. And the second is for the government not to approve anything that already has a licence but is waiting for its final development consent. So that's Rosebank, that's Cambo, which received their exploration licences decades ago. And that is about 3.5 billion barrels, actually, in already licensed but not yet consented reserves that are considered to be viable on the current kind of economics and commerciality of oil and gas extraction. So that's quite a lot, actually. And then I think if we can win those arguments and we will continue to draw attention to extensions to existing fields, it is much harder, I would say, to win the argument against new wells for existing fields because of the fact that often they don't require a new environmental impact assessment. There are fewer points for which at which we can engage with the development process, but I totally take your point that it requires more scrutiny, and if we had our way, we would stop it all. But we're doing what we can with what we can see as being the most clear and egregious, I think, parts of the fossil fuel system in the UK.
Wow, I told you she was good. Are you fired up and ready to get involved in this fight? Because I think Tessa needs us all, and give it up big for Tessa Khan, everybody.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.